Think about your own body for a second. I mean, you are built out of trillions of individual cells.
Trillions of them, yeah.
Right. And inside every single one of those microscopic cells, there's basically an entire galaxy of molecular machines.
That's absolutely.
You've got like little motors physically transporting cargo down cellular highways. You've got rotary engines generating energy. You've got these incredibly complex molecular pumps.
It's a bustling city in there.
It really is. Now, the standard narrative, the story that you and I and pretty much everyone listening were probably taught since high school biology, is that blind chance built all of this.
That's the textbook answer.
Yeah. The assumption is that once the very first primitive cell somehow existed, this completely unguided blind mechanism took over. We're taught that natural selection acting on random genetic mutations was this, well, this limitless creative engine.
Right, a boundless engine of innovation.
Exactly. An engine capable of building everything, seamlessly bridging the gap from a single bacterium all the way to, you know, the human brain.
And that narrative really is the central pillar of modern biological education. I mean, the underlying assumption there is one of infinite plasticity.
Infinite plasticity.
Yeah. The idea is that provided you have enough millions of years, natural selection can just mold and shape biological matter into literally any functional form required for an organism to survive.
Right.
And it's presented not just as a historical idea, but as this actively observed, mathematically sound engine of creation.
But what if you actually sit down and do the math?
That is the big question.
And I mean, the hard, unforgiving mathematics of population genetics. Because recently, a growing number of geneticists and biophysicists have started doing exactly that.
Yes, they have.
And when you look closely at the number, you start to realize that the universe might not actually be old enough to have built even a fraction of what we see.
The numbers are incredibly sobering.
So what if that assumed limitless plasticity is just, I mean, what if it's just a mathematical illusion?
Well, this tension between the assumed narrative and the actual math is exactly what we are auditing today.
Right.
We are stepping away from the traditional arguments over, you know, the fossil record or comparative anatomy.
We're ignoring the bones today.
Exactly. No bones.
Yeah.
Instead, we are looking straight into the quantitative mechanics of how genomes actually change over time.
And we have a phenomenal source for this deep dive.
We do. We're using the mathematical frameworks detailed in Chapter 8 of The Origin Enigma, which is the 2026 dissertation by Mohammed Tariq Arbab.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we dive into the numbers, we need to set a really strict boundary for today's deep dive.
A very necessary boundary.
Yeah, because if you've been following our ongoing discussions about the origins of life, you know how incredibly complex that topic is. Getting the first cell is a nightmare.
It's a massive hurdle.
But today, we're putting all of that aside. We are granting, just for the sake of the mathematical argument, that a fully functioning, replicating cell already exists.
We're giving evolution a massive head start.
A huge head start. Our focus today is exclusively on the modification of life. We're asking, once you have a living organism with a working genome, what are the actual quantifiable limits of what random mutation and natural selection can build?
In setting that boundary isolates the mechanism. We are isolating neo-Darwinian evolution to see what its actual engineering limits are.
Let's test the engine.
Exactly. And to understand those limits, we have to start at the most fundamental level of the genetic code.
Which means looking at the mutations themselves.
Right. And the source text makes a very sharp distinction right out of the gate between two very different types of genetic changes.
Okay.
You have single point mutations and you have coordinated mutations.
Let's start with single point mutations, because I think this is what most people picture when they hear the word mutation.
It's the classic typo scenario.
Yeah, we're talking about the DNA sequence, the A, C, T, and G chemical letters. A point mutation is just one of those letters getting swapped out by accident, right? Like an A is accidentally copied as a C.
That is the physical reality of it, yeah. When a cell divides, it has to copy its entire genome.
Millions of letters.
Millions or billions, depending on the organism. And the replication machinery is incredibly accurate, but it isn't perfect.
It makes typos.
It does. Occasionally, a single nucleotide, just one letter, is miscopied. And from a mathematical and probabilistic perspective, these single point mutations are trivial events.
Trivial meaning like they are practically inevitable.
Entirely inevitable. I mean, let's look at a large bacterial population, something like Escherichia coli.
E. coli, right.
Yeah, E. coli. It replicates quickly and exists in massive, massive populations.
Billions of them.
Exactly. So the scale of cellular replication in a standard bacterial colony is so vast that every single possible single point mutation.
Wait, every possible one.
Every possible one letter change across the entire genome is happening somewhere in that population every single day.
Wow.
The sheer raw numbers completely overcome the probability of the error.
Okay, so the random variation is just constantly being generated. It's a guarantee.
It's a biological guarantee.
And if one of those single letter changes happens to give a specific bacterium a tiny survival advantage, say, I don't know, it metabolizes a certain sugar slightly faster.
Sure.
Then natural selection spots it immediately. That specific bacterium divides faster, its offspring inherit the trait, and the new trait spreads through the colony.
And in that scenario, the mechanism works flawlessly.
Because it has so many options.
Right. Because the mutation occurs so frequently, natural selection has this constant daily buffet of minor variations to choose from.
Okay, so single point mutations are easy.
Very easy. But the explanatory power of this unguided process hits a massive wall when we shift our focus to coordinated mutations.
Coordinated mutations.
Yes. This is where the mathematical reality completely flips.
Okay, so by definition, coordinated means we aren't just looking for one random typo anymore. We are looking for multiple typos that have to work together.
Exactly. A coordinated mutational event requires two or more specific genetic changes to occur.
Together.
Either simultaneously or in a sequence where the intermediate steps offer absolutely no survival advantage to the organism.
Wow.
And in many cases, those intermediate steps aren't just useless. They are actually actively harmful.
Let me make sure I'm visualizing the biology here. Let's say an organism needs a new biological trait. Let's say a new binding site on a protein so it can attach to a new molecule in its environment.
Okay, good example.
And let's say that new binding site requires changing nucleotide A and nucleotide B in the DNA.
Right, it needs both.
If the blind mutation process only changes nucleotide A, the organism doesn't get half of a working binding site, does it?
Not at all. It gets a deformed, completely non-functional protein.
So it's useless.
Worse than useless. The cell has expended precious energy to transcribe and translate a sequence that does absolutely nothing.
Oh, so it's a waste of resources.
Exactly. Or worse, that misfolded protein gets in the way of other normal cellular processes. It becomes toxic clinker in the cell.
And this leads to what the text calls the evolutionary trap.
Yes, the evolutionary trap.
Because natural selection is entirely blind, right? It doesn't have a plan.
No foresight whatsoever.
Right, so it can't look at that useless intermediate protein and say, okay, this is garbage right now, but I'm going to preserve it in the gene pool because 1,000 generations from now, nucleotide B is going to mutate too, and then this is going to be an incredible survival advantage.
That is the crux of the trap. Selection operates strictly on what functions today. Right now.
It's ruthless.
Extremely. If a mutation does not provide an immediate, tangible, reproductive advantage in the current environment, natural selection will not select for it.
It throws it out.
In fact, if the mutation produces a useless, energy-wasting protein, natural selection will actively penalize the organism. It will weed that mutation out of the gene pool.
Because that organism is slightly less fit than its neighbors.
Precisely. Therefore, to achieve a trait that requires two specific coordinated mutations, the population can't rely on step-by-step selection.
Because the first step gets punished.
Right. So it has to rely on blind genetic drift to just wander aimlessly across this chasm of uselessness. Or
it has to hit the jackpot.
Yes. It has to win a simultaneous genetic lottery where both specific mutations happen in the exact same organism at the exact same time.
And when you require two specific things to happen by blind chance at the same time, the math gets brutal very quickly.
The probabilities multiply.
Walk me through that.
Well, if you were waiting for one specific single point mutation, and the baseline mutation rate means it has a 1 in 10 to the 8th chance of occurring per replication.
So 1 in 100 million.
Right. A large bacterial population will hit that number quickly. But if you need two specific coordinated mutations, you don't just add the probabilities. You multiply them.
Oh, boy.
You multiply 1 in 10 to the 8th by 1 in 10 to the 8th. So your probability suddenly drops to 1 in 10 to the 16th.
Which is astronomical.
It's exponential. The waiting time required for the population to stumble upon this dual event scales exponentially.
Okay, I can hear the pushback right now.
I mean,
Yeah.
especially from anyone who has taken a microbiology course.
The antibiotic resistance argument.
Exactly. What about antibiotic resistance? We are constantly warned about superbugs. We see evolution happening in real time in hospitals all over the world, with bacteria adapting to the strongest drugs we throw at them in a matter of just a few years.
It's a very common objection.
Right. So if the math is so restrictive, how is antibiotic resistance happening so fast?
Well, if we look closely at the actual molecular mechanisms of antibiotic resistance, it actually validates the mathematical limits we are discussing.
Really?
Yes, and the source material tackles this explicitly. Antibiotic resistance is almost universally the result of the single point mutations we just established as mathematically trivial.
Wait, so they aren't building new coordinated systems?
No, they are not. It is not the result of building novel coordinated machinery.
But the bacteria are defeating these complex chemical weapons. How are they doing that with just a single genetic typo?
By breaking things.
By breaking things.
Yes. Let's look at an antibiotic like streptomycin.
Okay.
Streptomycin works by latching onto a very specific part of the bacterial ribosome.
The ribosome is the machine that makes proteins, right?
Correct. The drug jams the ribosome so the bacteria can't function. And the ribosome is a highly complex coordinated structure.
So how does the single typo beat the drug?
A single point mutation in the bacterial DNA can slightly change the shape of that specific ribosomal attachment site, just deform it slightly.
Oh, I see.
The ribosome still functions well enough for the bacteria to barely survive and reproduce, but the streptomycin molecule can no longer fit into the slot to jam it.
So the bacteria survived, but it didn't build a new defense system at all.
Not at all.
It just deformed its own ribosome slightly so the drug couldn't grab onto it.
Precisely. Another really common mechanism is a single point mutation that breaks a cellular pump.
How does that work?
If an antibiotic normally enters the bacterial cell through a specific transport pore on the surface, a mutation that degrades or destroys that pore means the antibiotic simply can't get inside.
Because the door is broken.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The bacterium survives the hospital environment. It is absolutely an adaptive change.
Natural selection heavily favors it.
It does. But it is fundamentally a destructive or modifying process. It is degrading a pre-existing biological structure to evade a threat. It is not generative.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So a single mutation is essentially like, it's like breaking the lock on a door so you can escape a burning building.
That's a great analogy.
Right. Because yes, breaking the lock absolutely saves your life in that specific crisis.
Yeah.
But it didn't build you a new house.
No.
It just broke a mechanism that was already there. Coordinated mutations, on the other hand, would be like trying to build a fully integrated laser grid security system from scratch by just randomly crossing wires together in the dark.
That is a very fitting way to conceptualize it. Breaking a lock is a single, uncoordinated action that provides an immediate massive benefit in a life or death scenario.
Which bacteria do all the time.
They do. But building a security system requires multiple, coordinated, highly specific steps. And none of those steps provide any security at all until the entire system is wired correctly and powered on.
Right. Half a security system doesn't stop a burglar.
Exactly. And the math of population genetics shows that blind chance is incredibly efficient at breaking locks, but mathematically incapable of wiring the security system.
Okay, so the theoretical math makes sense, and the lock breaking analogy helps visualize it. But, you know, models and theories are only as good as the real-world data that backs them up.
Science requires empirical data.
Exactly. And this brings us to a massive reality check in the text. It details what is described as the largest empirical evolutionary experiment ever observed.
Yes, the Behe and Snoke analysis.
Right. Let's talk about the analysis done by Michael Behe and David Snoke and how it connects to malaria.
To test these theoretical limits, biophysicist Michael Behe and physicist David Snoke published a foundational paper in the journal Protein Science in 2004.
What were they trying to prove?
They wanted to strip away the assumptions and build a rigorous population genetics model. Their goal was to calculate exactly how long a population must wait for a novel protein feature to evolve.
Like a coordinated feature.
Specifically, a feature that requires multiple coordinated amino acid changes. For example, the formation of a new disulfide bond, which is something that stabilizes a protein's 3D structure.
Okay, but when you build a computer model like that, you have to plug in assumptions, right? Like population size and mutation rates. Wow. What kind of numbers were they working with?
They were very, very generous to the evolutionary mechanism. They modeled a massive population of 10 to the 9th organisms.
That's 1 billion individuals.
1 billion individuals experiencing constant mutation and selection.
And what did the math spit out? I mean, how long does it take a billion organisms to stumble into a 2 mutation coordinated trait?
The model predicted that for a trait requiring just 2 coordinated changes, a population of 1 billion organisms would have to wait roughly 10 to the 8th generations.
10 to the 8th. Okay, let's put that in normal terms.
Right. If we translate that into the lifespan of an average mammalian population, 10 to the 8th generations equates to roughly 2 million years.
2 million years?
Yes.
In a population of a billion animals, just to get 2 genetic letters to mutate and coordinate.
And it gets worse. If you ask the model for a feature that requires 3 coordinated changes,
just three,
the probability plummets so dramatically that the required waiting time exceeds the entire estimated age of the universe, even in that same massive population of a billion.
Wow. But again, that is the theoretical model, and there is always a danger in relying purely on computer models.
Of course.
Critics can always argue that the model was rigged, or that nature is somehow way more efficient than our algorithms.
Right. Biology is messy.
Yeah. And that is exactly why the text pivots to the ultimate empirical test case, the parasite Plasmodium falciparum.
The organism that causes malaria.
Right. So why is malaria the perfect real-world laboratory for this?
Malaria removes all the theoretical guesswork because it provides us with astronomical, fully measurable population numbers.
Because with mammals, we're just guessing.
Exactly. When we talk about mammalian evolution, we are guessing at historical population sizes. We don't really know how many hominins lived 2 million years ago, but with malaria, we know the numbers right now.
What are the numbers?
Epidemiologists estimate that at any given time, there are roughly 10 to the 20th individual malaria parasites infecting human hosts worldwide.
10 to the 20th. Let me write that out mentally. That's a 1 followed by 20 zeros.
100 quintillion parasites.
That is insane.
It is a staggering biological resource. Furthermore, these parasites reproduce incredibly rapidly, and over the last century, they have not just been mutating in a vacuum.
Right. We've been fighting them.
Exactly. They've been under intense life-or-death selective pressure from modern human medicine. We have basically carpet-bombed the global malaria population with anti-malarial drugs, specifically chloroquine.
So we have a population of 100 quintillion organisms, constantly reproducing, and they are under maximum evolutionary pressure to adapt or die.
Yeah.
This is evolution operating at its absolute maximum capacity.
Exactly. And this is where the theoretical Behe-Snoke model meets cold, hard reality.
Because chloroquine kills them.
Chloroquine is highly toxic to the malaria parasite. For the parasite to survive, it has to evolve resistance.
But earlier we said antibiotic resistance is just breaking a lock. Is chloroquine resistance the same?
No, and that's the key. Unlike some of the bacterial resistance we discussed earlier, evolving resistance to chloroquine is not as simple as breaking a single lock.
Why? What is the molecular hurdle here?
To survive chloroquine, the parasite must physically pump the drug out of its internal food vacuole before the drug kills it.
It has to actively remove it.
Right. To do this, it requires mutations in a specific transporter gene known as the PFCRT gene.
Okay.
But a single point mutation doesn't solve the problem.
So one typo doesn't fix the pump?
No. To alter the pump's specificity so that it ejects the chloroquine while still maintaining its essential everyday physiological functions, the parasite requires exactly 2 specific coordinated mutations in that gene.
Oh, well. So it's the exact evolutionary trap we outlined earlier, but playing out in real time across a global population.
Exactly. One mutation doesn't save the parasite. It actually makes it sick. It needs both mutations simultaneously to survive the drug.
And because we have decades of rigorous public health data tracking the spread of malaria and chloroquine resistance, we know exactly how often this blind, unguided process has successfully navigated that trap.
We have the receipts.
Right. So out of 100 quintillion parasites constantly reproducing over decades, how many times did they hit the 2 mutation jackpot?
The epidemiological data shows that this specific dual mutation event, this de novo emergence of chloroquine resistance, has only arisen spontaneously a mere handful of times in the entire recorded history of human medicine.
A handful.
Maybe fewer than 10 times globally.
Here's where it gets really interesting for you listening, because the human brain is simply not equipped to comprehend a number like 10 to the 20th.
We just can't picture it.
No, it's easy to gloss over it as just a really big number. So let's put it into a biological perspective.
The text notes that 10 to the 20th is roughly equivalent to the estimated number of all mammals that have ever lived on Earth since the Cambrian explosion.
It's an immense scale.
Every single mammal across hundreds of millions of years of geological history combined. That equals the number of malaria cells right now.
Yeah. And if you prefer a measure of time, think about it this way. If you are tasked with counting one single malaria parasite every second, and you never stop to eat or sleep.
Just counting one, two, three.
Right. It would take you over 3 trillion years to count to 10 to the 20th.
3 trillion years.
That is more than 200 times the current estimated age of our universe.
And the staggering takeaway from the source text is this. Planet Earth deployed that entire mind-boggling biological resource over decades of rapid reproduction to accomplish what amounts to a two-letter edit in a single gene.
This is the unvarnished empirical reality of population genetics. The malaria data demonstrates definitively that a two-letter coordinated change represents the absolute functional ceiling for higher organisms under Darwinian evolution.
The ceiling. You are saying that unguided evolution essentially maxes out at 2 coordinated mutations.
The data dictates that conclusion. I mean, if you are hypothesizing that the neo-Darwinian mechanism built complex anatomical novelties, structures that require dozens, hundreds, or thousands of coordinated genetic changes.
Like an eye or a wing.
Exactly. You are relying on a mechanism that the global malaria experiment proves is mathematically incapable of doing so within the lifetime of the universe.
That is a heavy conclusion. And obviously, mainstream evolutionary biology didn't just accept the Behean Snoke paper quietly.
Oh, not at all.
Right. If the empirical data from malaria aligns so perfectly with the dire predictions of the mathematical models, how did the mainstream establishment respond? I assume they tried to run their own numbers to prove Behe wrong.
They absolutely did. And the resulting literature is incredibly revealing. In 2008, 2 prominent mainstream population geneticists, Rick Durrett and Dina Schmidt, published a paper in the journal Genetics.
Okay, Durrett and Schmidt.
And their explicitly stated goal was to debunk Behe's math.
They went right after.
Yes. They argued that his modeling assumptions were overly restrictive, that he didn't properly account for the size of the genome, and that his waiting times were vastly inflated.
So Durrett and Schmidt built their own model using the assumptions that mainstream evolutionary biology prefers.
Correct.
And if I'm following the history correctly, they applied this new model to a theoretical hominid population, trying to model the evolutionary lineage leading to modern humans.
That's right. They wanted to prove that coordinated mutations could easily occur within the time frame of human evolution. So they set their model to calculate the waiting time for just 2 coordinated mutations in a hominid lineage.
And what did their own math reveal?
Well, it resulted in one of the most devastating mathematical backfires in modern biological literature.
How bad was it?
When Durrett and Schmidt ran the numbers using their own preferred relaxed assumptions, their model yielded a waiting time of 216 million years.
216 million years, just to get 2 coordinated mutations in a hominid population.
316 million years, yes.
But the total estimated evolutionary divergence time, the standard window from when we supposedly split from a common ape-like ancestor to the emergence of modern humans, is widely accepted to be only about 6 million years.
That is the inescapable paradox. The mainstream rebuttal in its attempt to rescue the evolutionary timeline mathematically proved a waiting time that is 36 times longer than the actual geological window allows.
36 times longer?
Yes. They intended to refute the waiting time problem, but instead they rigorously quantified it. Their own published math proved that the hominid timeline is mathematically impossible under unguided mechanisms.
I just want to sit with that for a second. You have a 6 million year window to evolve from a primate ancestor into a human. The anatomical, cognitive, and developmental differences between a chimpanzee-like ancestor and a human require millions of precise genetic changes.
Millions of them.
Yet the mainstream's own mathematical defense admits that it takes 216 million years just to line up 2 of those genetic letters. The math doesn't just fail, it fails catastrophically.
It is a catastrophic failure of the underlying mechanism, and the source text doesn't stop with hominids.
Where does it go next?
It introduces what it calls the species pair challenge, examining other major transitions in the fossil record. And the prime example used is the evolution of the whale.
Oh, whale evolution. That is heavily featured in biology textbooks as the classic success story of the fossil record.
It's everywhere.
You see the charts with the small, dog-like land animal slowly turning into a giant marine mammal.
It is the textbook icon, but when we apply the population genetics math to the anatomical reality, the story collapses.
How so?
According to the standard evolutionary timeline, terrestrial archaeodactyls, these are land-dwelling, even-toed mammals, similar to a modern hippopotamus or a deer.
Okay, a land animal.
Right. They supposedly evolved into fully marine cetaceans, modern whales, in a geological window of just 5 to 8 million years.
Let's break down what that transition actually requires from an engineering standpoint. I mean, what does it physically mean to turn a deer-like animal into a whale in 5 million years?
It is an almost incomprehensible cascade of anatomical rewiring.
Give me some examples.
Well, it requires the complete reorganization of the respiratory system, migrating the nasal passages from the snout all the way to the top of the head to form a blowhole.
And you need muscles for that, right?
Exactly, complete with highly specialized muscular valves to seal out water when diving. It requires the total loss of the hind limbs and the detachment of the pelvis from the vertebral column to allow for the powerful up and down undulation of the tail fluke.
And what about their senses? I mean, a land animal's vision and hearing are totally useless in the deep ocean.
Precisely. The transition requires the development of an entirely novel echolocation system.
Which is incredibly complex.
It is. This isn't just a minor modification. It requires new specialized vocal organs to generate high-frequency clicks. It requires the development of the melon, which is a massive organ of specialized fat tissue in the forehead used as an acoustic lens to focus the sound waves.
An acoustic lens made of fat.
Yes. And it requires heavily modified inner ear structures, which have to be completely isolated from the skull by dense bone just to receive the returning echoes and determine direction in the water.
And all of these highly coordinated interdependent systems have to be built by random genetic typos in just 5 to 8 million years.
Yes. Now, apply the Durrett and Schmidt mathematical reality.
The 216 million years.
Right. If it takes a mammalian population 216 million years just to stumble upon two coordinated genetic mutations, the proposition that unguided random mutations could successfully rewrite the entire respiratory, skeletal, cardiovascular, and acoustic systems of a terrestrial mammal in a mere 5 to 8 million years is mathematically preposterous.
It's statistically absurd.
It is.
So if I'm an evolutionary biologist and I'm staring down the barrel of this math, how do I defend the theory?
They have a few theories.
I know there is a specific counterargument often raised regarding neutral networks.
Yes, neutral networks.
The idea is that an organism doesn't actually have to make these massive risky jumps across the chasm of uselessness we talked about earlier. Instead, they theorize that genetic sequence space is full of these safe, neutral pathways.
The stepping stones.
Right. The organism drifts along this pathway, accumulating mutations that don't help, but crucially, they don't hurt either. It wanders safely across what they call the fitness landscape until it suddenly finds itself just one tiny step away from a brand new, highly functional trait.
The neutral network hypothesis is the most common theoretical escape hatch. However, the source text exposes how it fundamentally misunderstands the physical chemistry of biological molecules.
How so?
Well, for neutral networks to solve the waiting time problem, the fitness landscape must be perfectly smooth and continuously navigable.
Meaning every single step on the path has to be safe.
Precisely. Every single intermediate genetic change along that hypothetical neutral path must result in a protein that stably folds and functions well enough that the organism isn't penalized by natural selection.
And why is that a physical problem?
Because it requires an unimaginable level of what the text calls algorithmic fine-tuning.
Fine-tuning?
Yeah. Biological proteins are built from 20 specific amino acids. For a neutral network to exist, the chemical affinities and binding properties of those 20 amino acids must be perfectly, exquisitely tuned to allow for the smooth stepping stone navigation.
And if they aren't?
If their chemical properties were even slightly different, the fitness landscape wouldn't be smooth. It would be jagged, filled with deep thermodynamic valleys of non-function.
So the defense assumes the existence of the very fine-tuning it's trying to explain away.
Exactly. To invoke neutral networks as a solution is to assume that unguided nature somehow preloaded the chemical sequence space with a perfectly tuned, highly forgiving landscape that naturally guides random walks toward complex function.
It begs the question entirely.
It does. It requires foresight and design built into the very fabric of the chemical elements.
So far, we've been looking at this from a macro level. Whole organisms, hominids, whales, traits that require multiple genes.
But what happens if we zoom all the way down to the foundational level?
Down to the proteins.
Yeah. What happens if we ignore the whale entirely and just try to build one single brand new molecular machine? How long does it take to invent a genuinely novel protein fold? This leads us into the fascinating experimental work detailed in section 8.5.
Yes, this is where the theoretical arguments meet the actual bench chemistry. We are looking at the foundational research of molecular biologist Douglas Axe.
Who is Douglas Axe?
He's a highly respected researcher. In the standard neo-Darwinian model, the assumption is that protein sequence space is incredibly dense with functional forms. The belief is that you can easily mutate your way from one functional protein fold to another.
Or the smooth landscape.
But Axe didn't want to rely on assumptions. He wanted to physically measure the rarity of a functional protein fold in a lab.
So if I'm Douglas Axe and I want to know the real odds of getting a new fold, I can't just run a computer simulation with assumed variables. I have to physically alter the proteins in a lab and see if they actually survive the changes.
Exactly.
Is that what site-directed mutagenesis is?
That's the exact principle. You don't guess. You measure. Site-directed mutagenesis is a technique where a scientist intentionally creates specific mutations at targeted sites within a DNA sequence to see how the resulting protein behaves.
Okay, so what did Axe mutate?
Axe took an existing functioning enzyme called beta-lactamase. He systematically altered the sequence to calculate exactly how many coordinated changes it would take to bridge the structural gap and evolve a genuinely novel, stable protein fold from the pre-existing one.
And what was the number? How many specific changes did it take to get a new fold?
He found that to successfully bridge the gap to a genuinely new fold, it requires, on average, 5 to 7 coordinated amino acid substitutions.
Wait, we just established that waiting for just 2 coordinated changes takes 216 million years in hominids and requires 100 quintillion organisms in malaria.
Right.
Now, Axe is demonstrating that you need 5 to 7 coordinated changes just to get a new basic building block.
Yes, 5 to 7. And he went further. Axe used this empirical data to calculate the overall distribution of functional folds within the vast space of all possible amino acid sequences.
And what did he find?
He found that functional protein folds are not common at all.
The landscape isn't dense.
Not even close. They are like incredibly tiny microscopic islands of function, isolated in a near-infinite ocean of molecular gibberish.
How isolated? I mean, what is the actual ratio of functional proteins to garbage sequences?
The empirical ratio Axe measured is 1 in 10 to the 77th.
1 in 10 to the 77th.
Let me put that into perspective. There are roughly 10 to the 80th atoms in the entire observable universe.
Atoms in the universe.
Yes. That means for every one specific sequence of amino acids that successfully folds into a stable, functional protein, there are 10 to the 77th alternative sequences that are just useless, non-functional chains.
So if a bacterial population is blindly mutating, trying to stumble upon a new functional fold, how long is the wait?
Axe calculated that for a large bacterial population to blindly search the sequence space and stumble upon a novel functional fold by chance, the waiting time is approximately 10 to the 80th years.
But the entire universe is only estimated to be about 13.8 billion years old.
Yeah.
That's roughly 10 to the 10th years.
Right. So the time required to blindly evolve a single novel protein fold exceeds the entire age of the universe by 70 orders of magnitude.
It is a temporal impossibility.
Completely impossible.
Let me push on the physical mechanics of this, because I want to make sure you and I and everyone listening really grasp why this gap is so unbridgeable.
It comes down to physics.
Right. Why can't the protein just slowly mutate step by step, taking a million years to slowly morph from fold A to fold B?
That brings us to the strict thermodynamic requirements of protein stability, which is heavily emphasized in the source material.
Okay. What does protein stability mean here?
For a protein to function as a machine or an enzyme, it cannot be a floppy, loose chain of chemicals. It must fold into a highly specific, stable, three-dimensional shape.
Like a key fitting a lock.
Exactly. This precise shape is dictated by the sequence of amino acids, particularly the hydrophobic, which means water-repelling amino acids. They collapse into the center of the protein to form a stable core.
It's like building an intricate architectural arch. Every stone has to be angled perfectly to lock the structure in place.
That's a perfect way to picture it. And this stable structure fiercely resists random changes. If you start randomly mutating the sequence, pulling stones out of the arch, the physical structure loses its thermodynamic stability.
The arch collapses.
It collapses. Now, if you try to mutate from fold A to fold B one step at a time, the intermediate sequences, the halfway points between the two folds, are thermodynamically unstable.
They don't just hold a new shape.
No, they don't form a neat alternative shape. They lose their structural integrity entirely and unravel into a loose chain.
And what happens to a loose chain of amino acids floating around inside a living cell?
It faces a highly hostile environment. The interior of a cell is an aqueous environment. It's filled with water, and water is a highly reactive solvent.
Oh, interesting.
Through a process called hydrolysis, water actively attacks and degrades these unstable, unfolded intermediate chains.
It attacks them.
Yes. Long before natural selection can ever act on these intermediate forms to somehow preserve them, the water literally dissolves them back into raw material.
That is a brilliant clarification. So the neutral stepping stone path doesn't exist because the bridge literally washes away in the water before you can take the second step.
It washes away completely.
You'd have to jump the entire chasm all at once. And jumping the chasm requires 5 to 7 coordinated changes, leading to the 10 to the 80th year waiting time.
You cannot inch your way across an ocean of thermodynamic instability. The physics of the cell actively prohibit it.
Okay, but what about the massive advancements we are seeing in artificial intelligence?
AlphaFold.
Yes, exactly. I am constantly seeing headlines about AI programs, specifically Google's AlphaFold, predicting millions of protein structures.
It's a marvel of engineering.
It really is, and it makes it sound like we have mapped out protein space and found that it's actually packed full of easily accessible functional shapes. Doesn't the success of AlphaFold prove that functional proteins are actually easy to find?
It is a very common objection, driven heavily by tech headlines. But the source text systematically dismantles it by exposing what it calls the Oracle fallacy.
The Oracle fallacy. Okay, what is that?
AlphaFold is an astonishing feat of human engineering and computer science, no doubt. But to understand its relevance to evolution, we have to look strictly at how neural networks are trained. AlphaFold was trained exclusively on a data set called the Protein Data Bank.
And what exactly is the Protein Data Bank?
It is a massive, meticulously compiled database containing only already evolved, highly specified functional biological sequences that scientists have isolated from living organisms over decades.
Wait, so it's only looking at successful proteins?
Exactly. It is a library of pre-existing biological design. AlphaFold uses a human-engineered machine learning algorithm to find structural patterns within that pre-existing design. It learns the rules of how known proteins fold.
Oh, I see. It's interpolating between known data points.
Precisely. It is interpolating within a biologically pre-constrained landscape. It does not start from a random sequence of molecular gibberish and blindly stumble toward function.
It already has the answer key.
It essentially smuggles the target information, the rules of biological folding into the simulation from the very beginning.
So arguing that AlphaFold proves evolution is easy is like, well, it's like training an AI on the complete works of Shakespeare and then acting shocked when the AI knows how to perfectly format a sonnet.
That's a great comparison.
Right, because it doesn't prove that ink and paper, randomly blowing in the wind, can write a sonnet. It just proves the AI learned the rules of Shakespeare from reading Shakespeare.
That is the exact logical leap being made by the critics. AlphaFold doesn't simulate an unguided chemical search. As the text argues, the success of AlphaFold actually proves the opposite of what evolutionists claim.
How does it prove the opposite?
It proves that navigating the astronomical vastness of protein sequence space effectively requires a highly sophisticated intelligence.
In this case, Google's engineers.
Right. Brilliant human programmers and advanced machine learning actively directing the search based on a massive database of prior knowledge. Blind chemistry does not have a training data set.
It has no oracle.
Exactly.
So let's tie this all together so far. We have established, through theoretical models, the empirical data of malaria, the hominid timeline failure, and the thermodynamics of protein folding, that the waiting time to build new coordinated genetic information is effectively forever.
Forever.
It wildly exceeds the age of the universe. But here is the terrifying next logical step.
The systemic decline.
Yes. Genomes aren't just frozen in amber while they wait 10 to the 80th years. They are alive. They are constantly replicating and they are constantly mutating.
They never stop.
So if they aren't successfully building new, complex things, what is happening to the genome during those millions of years?
And this leads us to the final and perhaps the darkest reality revealed by population genetics. We are moving from the inability to bear up to the inevitability of breaking down.
Breaking down.
Yes. This centers on two major systemic concepts. genetic entropy, and Haldane's dilemma. Let's start with genetic entropy, which is a concept deeply formalized by geneticist John Sanford.
Okay, entropy is a term we usually hear in physics. Specifically, the second law of thermodynamics, the universal tendency of all ordered systems to naturally move toward disorder and decay over time, like a hot cup of coffee cooling down.
Right.
How does Sanford apply that concept to biology?
Sanford applied the concept directly to biological information. He pointed out a massive flaw in how we are traditionally taught to view mutations. We tend to view mutations through two extreme lenses.
Which are?
We think they are either wonderfully beneficial, like a superpower, in which case natural selection preserves them, or we think they are fatally destructive, causing a severe birth defect, in which case the organism dies and the mutation is immediately purged from the population.
We think of it as a binary system, good or fatal.
Great. But Sanford's rigorous analysis of mutation rates showed that the vast, overwhelming majority of mutations are neither. They fall into a massive middle ground that population geneticists call the nearly neutral zone.
The nearly neutral zone. What does that mean?
These are mutations that are only slightly deleterious.
Slightly deleterious. So they cause damage, but not enough to kill the organism.
Exactly. They cause a tiny microscopic loss of biological information. Maybe a cellular motor becomes 0.001% less efficient.
Tiny glitch.
Right. The damage is so vanishingly small that it doesn't noticeably affect the organism's overall fitness or reproductive capability.
Which means natural selection is completely blind to it. If the organism survives and reproduces at the normal rate, selection has no mechanism to weed that tiny error out.
Natural selection cannot see the nearly neutral mutations at all. And because selection can't remove them, these slightly deleterious mutations accumulate in the genome generation after generation endlessly.
Wow.
Sanford likens it to microscopic layers of rust on a car. One single flake of rust doesn't stop the engine. You don't even notice it's there.
But over time.
But over deep time, this relentless, unpurgable accumulation degrades the overall informational content of the genome. The genetic hardware of the population is slowly, inevitably rusting away.
It's like photocopying a highly detailed blueprint.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
The first copy looks fine. But if you copy the copy and then copy that copy a million times over, even if you try to throw away the copies that are completely blacked out or totally ruined, the tiny little smudges and artifacts from the scanner are going to accumulate.
They absolutely will.
And eventually the blueprint is going to be completely unreadable. The information is just lost entropy.
That is genetic entropy in a nutshell. And it paints a picture of a genome that is on a slow downward trajectory, not an upward march of limitless creativity.
It's degrading.
Yes. But the situation is actually compounded by the second concept, Haldane's dilemma.
J.B.S. Haldane was one of the founding fathers of modern population genetics, wasn't he? So this isn't even a new concept.
No, not at all. Haldane formulated this dilemma way back in 1957. He was a brilliant evolutionary biologist, and he was trying to calculate the absolute speed limit of evolution. He focused on what he called the cost of substitution.
Let's break down the cost. What does it actually cost a population to evolve?
Well, when a new supposedly beneficial mutation arises in a single individual, it doesn't just magically upload into the DNA of the entire species overnight.
Like a software update.
Right. It doesn't work like that. For evolution to progress, that new version of the gene has to spread through the population and entirely replace the old version. In genetics, this is called fixation, when the new trait reaches 100% saturation in the population.
Right. And the only way the new trait takes over is if the individuals carrying it out reproduce the individuals who don't.
And that is exactly where the cost is paid. For the new trait to achieve fixation, a significant portion of the individuals carrying the old trait must fail to reproduce or die prematurely.
Because there's a finite amount of resources.
Exactly. That differential mortality, the selective death toll, is the cost of substitution. Haldane realized that a population can only sustain a finite amount of selective death before the entire species just goes extinct.
That makes sense. You can't kill off 90% of your population every single generation just to lock in a new trait. The population would collapse.
Precisely. So there is a mathematical speed limit to how fast a population can safely lock in new traits without dying off.
A hard mathematical speed limit based on reproductive rates.
Yes. Haldane calculated that, given typical reproductive rates, a standard vertebrate population can safely fix, meaning spread to 100% of the population, a maximum of about one beneficial mutation every 300 generations.
One mutation every 300 generations.
Let's apply Haldane's speed limit back to the hominid window we talked about earlier.
Let's do it. If you take that 6-million-year window from a common ape-like ancestor to modern humans, and you apply Haldane's strict limit, the math allows for a total of perhaps a few thousand fixed substitutions.
Just a few thousand individual genetic changes. But wait, the genetic difference between humans and chimpanzees isn't just a few thousand letters.
The differences are in the tens of millions.
Tens of millions.
The anatomical reorganization, the expansion of the neocortex, the development of language centers, these require millions of coordinated genetic changes. Haldane's limit rigorously demonstrates that the genomic bandwidth of the population simply cannot accommodate the required substitution rate within the time available.
The concept of bandwidth really ties these two grim realities together.
Yeah.
Tell me if this analogy tracks with the science.
Let's hear it.
Imagine a massive global corporation. The workers are making thousands of tiny, completely undetectable accounting errors every single day. That is genetic entropy, the constant accumulation of those nearly neutral mutations.
Right.
Management is in a state of constant panic, using every single resource they have just trying to hunt down and fix these daily typos to keep the company from going bankrupt. That is the bandwidth constraint.
I like this.
Because they are using 100% of their energy just to tread water, they have absolutely zero time, resources, or capital left to research and develop a brand new revolutionary product.
They're tapped out.
And even if they somehow did invent a new product, strict corporate regulations dictate they're only allowed to launch one new product every 300 years. And that is Haldane's limit.
The analogy is deeply accurate to the biological reality. A population that is expending all of its selective power just to purge the worst genetic errors and tread water against the relentless tide of genetic entropy simply has no selective bandwidth left to identify, preserve, and fix novel coordinated beneficial mutations.
But surely modern geneticists have tried to solve Haldane's dilemma since 1957. I mean, they must have some answer.
They have proposed various theoretical workarounds. They suggest things like soft selection or the idea of parallel processing, where different beneficial mutations arise in separate subpopulations and then eventually merge together.
Does that work?
These mechanisms only marginally increase the speed for single independent mutations. They mathematically fail to solve the problem for coordinated traits.
Ah, we are back to the coordinated trap.
Exactly. You cannot evolve the specialized acoustic melon of a whale in a subpopulation in the Atlantic, evolve the specialized inner ear bone in a subpopulation in the Pacific, and then hope they magically combine hundreds of thousands of years later.
Right, because neither piece is helpful on its own.
Coordinated changes, by their very nature, must co-occur and be selected for in the exact same genetic lineage at the same time. The mathematical limits remain completely unbroken.
Wow. The journey we have taken today through the hard math of population genetics is sobering, to say the least. We have rigorously audited the assumed plasticity of the neo-Darwinian engine, and the numbers have consistently painted a very different picture than the standard narrative.
A vastly different picture.
Let's quickly recap exactly what the math has shown us today. We started at the fundamental level, distinguishing between single-point mutations, which are mathematically trivial, and account for things like breaking cellular locks to resist antibiotics, and coordinated mutations, which trap unguided evolution because natural selection is blind to useless intermediate steps.
And we grounded that theoretical trap in the largest empirical evolutionary experiment on Earth, the malaria parasite. We saw that even with a staggering population of 10 to the 20th organisms intensely reproducing under maximum selective pressure, the empirical data proves that a two-letter coordinated change represents an absolute functional ceiling.
Right. And from there, we exposed the devastating backfire of the mainstream defense. Dirt and Schmidt attempted to debunk the math, but their own models prove that waiting for just two coordinated mutations in a hominid population takes 216 million years, crushing the 6-million-year window available for human evolution and making the 5-million-year transition of a land mammal into a whale mathematically preposterous.
Then we zoom down to the molecular level with Douglas Axe's work, exploring the thermodynamic reality of protein stability. We saw that functional protein folds are isolated islands in an ocean of gibberish, requiring 5 to 7 coordinated changes to bridge the gap.
And because water actively hydrolyzes unstable intermediate chains, the waiting time for a new fold explodes to 10 to the 80th years, which is 70 orders of magnitude longer than the age of the universe.
And finally, we looked at the systemic decline of the genome. The relentless accumulation of nearly neutral mutations, genetic entropy, slowly rusts the biological hardware.
compounded by Haldane's cost of substitution, which mathematically caps the speed at which any new trait can be locked into a population, the genetic bandwidth is essentially choked.
It is. The ultimate unvarnished takeaway from Chapter 8 of The Origin Enigma is stark. Population genetics strictly limits the supposed boundless creativity of neo-Darwinism. The plasticity we are all taught to assume is, mathematically speaking, an illusion.
Which leaves us with a profound final thought. The overarching theme of our entire analysis today is that unguided mechanisms are highly efficient at breaking things, fine-tuning existing systems, and slowly degrading pre-existing information. But the hard mathematics prove they are fundamentally incapable of generating novel, coordinated complexity.
They just don't have the tools.
So the inevitable question must be asked. If unguided chemistry and blind selection mathematically cannot write new genetic code, where did the astronomical volume of original biological information come from? If the hardware of life is slowly rusting away, who wrote the software?
That is the ultimate question.
And it's a question that lingers long after the numbers have settled, and it completely reframes how you look at the natural world. Thank you for joining us on this incredibly deep dive into the math of life. We encourage you to seek out the source material, look closely at the numbers yourself, follow the evidence wherever it leads, and never stop questioning the consensus.